Turning now to the first book of Samuel, chapter 13 and verse 1. 1 Samuel, chapter 13, verse 1. Our subject being faith demonstrated in the life of Samuel. And the words of the first verse read, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose him. Well, we've come to the monarchy after the period of the judges. We've observed that God gave Israel a king in anger. While it was his will that there should be a monarchy, that there should be a king, nevertheless, it was not the best thing for them. It was because his people desired a king and rejected the theocracy that existed under the judges. Well, I won't remind you of the details, except to say that God gave a king partly to reprove them. Having a king would be no answer to their national problems. The answer, of course, was for them to trust in the living God. But then it was God's will that they should have a king, even though it was wrong they should ever have asked for one or desired one, because the ancient order would provide types of Jesus Christ. And every form of officer who was appointed in that Old Testament period would be a type of Christ. The prophet, the priest, the deliverer, as with the judges, and of course the king. But then also it was God's desire that through their experience with kings, some of whom would be good, but never infallible, and most of whom would be bad, it was God's will that they should be taught to yearn and long for the Messiah, the perfect king, their eternal spiritual king. And it was also God's will to give them a monarchy, inferior as it was to the old theocracy, because it would speak to the church of the gospel age. And all these things are written ultimately for our learning. And I've tried to explain that at some length. Throughout the gospel age and the period of the church, there'll always be a desire, will enter in, even among godly Christians, to think that the world's way of doing things is better than the Lord's way of doing things. And so people will desire big denominations with centralized power, the power of lots of people united in some kind of national or international organization. And the experience of the monarchy warns us that in spiritual matters, that is a disaster and always leads to problems. In human reasoning, it might seem to be a good thing. Why not have a national institution? Not the simple, autonomous, self-governing, independent, reliant upon the Lord, local churches that the Lord has ordained. But we're warned in the Old Testament that when we drift from his way into ours, then there's always trouble and difficulty. And so it's proved, because the history of denominations has been a dismal history. And we'll go into that more at another time. But I want to come directly to this 13th chapter and the astonishing lessons that this and subsequent chapters provide. And most of all, I want to, would like to, apply the third of the purposes of the monarchy to bring us to yearn for Christ. And certainly the experience of Saul contrasts with the attributes and the work of Christ, and we'll note that as time permits. So chapter 13, verse 1, Saul reigned 1 year. Well, the Hebrew is very curious indeed. It really says he was 1 year old, or words to that effect. And sometimes the translators are very puzzled by this, and they say, well, maybe it should read, he was 31 years old, and something slipped out. But our translators in the King James Version, they're not alone in this, have decided that it means that the first birthday of Saul's reign had passed, and he was into his second year. So they translated along those lines. Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years. Some people say that it was probably a symbolic sense that the Hebrew has, that Saul was like a one-year-old in that he'd accomplished nothing in his first year as king. He'd hardly started. Well, he'd achieved the Ammonite incursion and dealing with that, but that's just about all. Nothing had happened after that. And others say it's symbolic, and it means that he was a very naive king, as it turned out, and he was as bad as a one-year-old. And others go beyond that and say, well, it's more that he was totally innocent of any fault or crime in his first year, and it was the second year that that all started. Well, the symbolic possibilities are so wide that I think our translators have done the wisest thing and assumed that the Hebrew means he'd reigned 1 year. His reign was 1 year old, and now he was into his second. But enough of technicalities. He was in his second year, and verse 2, he chose him 3,000 men of Israel to be a permanent standing army or bodyguard. 2,000 attended him, and 1,000 attended his son Jonathan. And the significance of this is that he disbanded the army after the Ammonite troubles and sent them all home, but he didn't at once form a large standing army. This is a very limited number, 3,000. What was he going to do with them? What was the purpose of them? You either disband altogether, which had been the way of Israel, or you begin to organize an army which is going to do something about the Philistines, because that's what he was appointed to do. The terms of his being king and being appointed was to be a captain over Israel to deal with the oppression. But he doesn't seem to be in any hurry. And that, I think, is the signal given by this very small standing army. So you come to verse 3 of chapter 13. And Jonathan, who seems to be far more forward, with his mere 1,000, smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. Now, that's remarkable. There are all sorts of possibilities, but the chief one seems to be that Jonathan, knowing that his father was appointed to defeat the Philistines, was rather impetuous and impatient. He certainly seems to be a man of faith, we learn later, and he started straight away. Perhaps there was some provocation from the Philistine garrison, but he gets pitched in and he disturbs them. How much damage he did, we don't know, but it really caused a tremendous reaction, and you read about it in the third verse. Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines, and Saul instantly knew there was trouble, and he blew the trumpet throughout all the land. Let the Hebrews hear, in verse 4 of chapter 13, and all Israel heard that Saul had smitten a garrison of the Philistines. Well, he took the credit through his messengers, but it was really he that was inactive, and Jonathan that started things going. And that they heard that Israel also was had in abomination with the Philistines. Some people have suggested that there was a pact in existence and that Jonathan broke that pact and therefore brought disgust upon Israel. But there's no evidence or hint of that. It may be so, but what is more likely is that the Philistines, who dominated the region for so long, did regard the Israelites as pathetic and an abomination, and they'd had the audacity to hit back in some way, and so they were going to be very severely dealt with. And so you read here that the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal, end of verse 4, while verse 5, the Philistines gathered themselves together. It didn't happen instantly, took a little while, to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots. That causes some amazement, and there are the Some of the modern versions modify that to 3,000, assuming there's a scribal error flying around somewhere. But we have 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore. So just about every Philistine, possibly, was brought in over a huge area and they pitched in Michmash. There could have been 30,000 chariots if you assume that many of these vehicles were simply baggage carriers. The Philistines had a lot of kit, a lot of gear, a lot of provisions, 6,000 cavalry and numerous foot soldiers, so it's quite in order. I don't think we need to rush to assume all sorts of textual errors and alter the rendering, but so I'm happy if you are with 30,000 chariots. Anyway, they gathered a vast number. And verse 6, when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves. They began to desert and abandon and hide from call-up or conscript or whatever. And they chose all sorts of places to conceal themselves. As they arrived to take up their place in the battle line, they got a view of the huge numbers of Philistines and immediately abandoned. And in the end, Saul himself was down, we read later, to 600 men. And verse 7, some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. They went east, they ran away a considerable distance. And others, we later read, and earlier also, went over, deserted to the Philistines and put themselves in their charge. And all the people followed Saul in Gilgal, trembling. And verse 8, he waited 7 days. And look at this, according to the set time that Samuel had appointed. Well, that takes us a little by surprise, because back in chapter 10, verse 8, we do read that Samuel had this arrangement with Saul that he'd wait for him for 7 days for instructions, battle instructions, in trouble. In chapter 10, in verse 8, it gives the impression it was just for that occasion. But here in chapter 13, we learn that it was obviously a standing order that Saul must never go to war without consulting Samuel and seeking the Lord's will through him. And we understand that Samuel had said to him, you could do all sorts of things as king according to your own wisdom, but when it's war, you send for me, and in 7 days I will come and we will consult, and you're under orders. But it seems that was the arrangement. And this is the reason why Saul was punished by God for his disobedience. He waited 7 days, but he didn't wait a full 7 days. Maybe 7.5 days, maybe 7.75 days. Because late on the 7th day, Samuel came. And what had happened in verse 9 is that Saul had said, bring hither a burnt offering to me and peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. Now people jump on that and they say, ah, Saul wasn't a priest. This was his great sin. But the narrator often puts things like this, and there's no reason to believe otherwise than that Saul got hold of a priest. And when it says Saul made the offering, he didn't necessarily make it. He had a priest with him. We shall see that in due course. But he ordered it without Samuel. He didn't wait for Samuel. And verse 10, it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of offering, the burnt offering, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, that he might salute him. Now we're beginning to discover a whole lot of problems with Saul. He wasn't convinced he needed Samuel. He was in a tight spot. And he decided, instead of waiting for Samuel, as ordered, to make those offerings and to bring him in commands, he would go ahead on his own. When he was first made king, he was humble and he was afraid, and he even hid himself, you'll remember, when the time for his appointment came. But now he's brazen and confident, and having completely disobeyed the Lord's command to him, he goes out to meet Samuel to salute him, that is, to recognize him. Oh, how very nice. he condescends to go out and to hail and greet and extend his lordly recognition to Samuel, from whom he was supposed to be taking his instructions. He's become brazen and superior so quickly, it's only his second year. And verse 11, Samuel said, "What hast thou done?" Immediately he knows, of course, and he calls him to order. And verse 11, Saul's language is equally brazen. Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that thou camest not within the days appointed," it's their fault, and it's Samuel's fault, evidently, for being late, which he wasn't, "and that the Philistines gathered themselves together at Michmash, therefore said I, the Philistines will come down now upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. I forced myself, therefore," didn't sound like it earlier, "and offered a burnt offering." And Samuel said to Saul, "Thou hast done foolishly." Wasn't it incredibly foolish? His situation was so dangerous. He had a mere 600 men. Everyone had deserted. And there were these Philistines with thousands upon thousands, and chariots and cavalry. And for the sake of a couple of hours, he thinks he can go ahead without Samuel and a proper calling upon the Lord and instructions from God. That's barely foolishness, that's madness. He desperately needed, never more did he need, the help of God in his situation. And so he dealt so foolishly and, of course, faithlessly. Look at the reasons as he lays them out. The people are scattered. Why didn't he take steps to gather them or to rally them? No, he's thinking rationally. My troops are dying away. I better get on with this. But he wasn't called to be king of a secular nation and figure things out rationally. He was called to act by faith and to obey God. And he should have said, "This is God's people. I am under God's instruction to wait a full 7 days for Samuel. That is what I must do. I mustn't process this entirely rationally, as though this were a secular nation, but spiritually." And that's what we have to learn, isn't it? One of the things that's going wrong in evangelicalism is that people, and many of them mean well and are Bible believers, are saying, "Well, things are so difficult and the churches are so small and things are so low. We've got to figure out all kinds of ingenious ways of reaching the people. We can't any longer go by the methods that God has laid down in his words. They're too solemn. They're too straight-laced. These things, the word of God and reliance on prayer and the Holy Spirit, we've got to adapt and be worldly and use all kinds of techniques and so on. But we're not supposed to think as though we're secular companies and industrial enterprises. We're supposed to realize we are God's people. We're under his order. Why, it's foolish if we think we can do it a different way without his blessing. The more desperate our situation becomes, the more of a minority in a more and increasingly secular world, the more we need the help of God. How foolish to resort to human methods and human wisdom. But we see this reflected in Saul. He's thinking like a secular general and not the king of God's people, of a spiritual nation. And then he claims the prophet is late. Well, he's not, of course. This is all in verse 11 of chapter 13. It's untrue. It's his own lack of respect for his need of the prophet and of God's help. And he fears the Philistine build-up there in verse 11. Secular thinking again. And in verse 12, he desperately needs to give the order to attack and to get on with it, because otherwise the Philistines will attack him. Well, enough of that. You can see it's entirely secular thinking. So what he decides is, I'll disobey God's command. I'll create my own strategy. But of course, even though Samuel isn't here, we will quickly get this sacrifice done and pray. We'll not leave that out. And that's how people think today. We'll break God's rules. will create entirely new methods, which are nowhere to be found in the Bible, but we'll sanitize them by praying about it. And we'll bring them before the Lord in a prayer meeting and just get on with it. Exactly what Saul was doing. So these things are for our learning, and we don't want to behave in this way, in this way. Now look at verse 14. "But now," says Samuel, "thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, a man who identifies with God and his tastes and his methods and obeys him, and he wants God's agenda to be carried out." And so David would soon be sought, and that is something we have to learn. If we would have instrumentality, we want to be after God's own heart. Well, look down to verse 15. "Samuel arose, gat him up from Gilgal unto Gibeah of Benjamin," but he doesn't seem to take any further part. He knows exactly what's going to happen, that Saul will dither and that Jonathan will get on with it. "And Saul numbered the people that were present with him," this is the end of verse 15, "about 600 men. And Saul and Jonathan his son and the rest of the party, and who they were and what they did, are named in due course." And verse 17, "The spoilers came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies." There's a lot of them. These spoilers might be doing anything, burning the fields, just causing what trouble they could, disturbing even more the Israelites. It may be that they actually were imposing this regulation, which took away all the arms from the Israelites. But I would think it more likely that that had already been done, and we read about that in due course, that the Israelites were barely unarmed, and we see how. But I'm going to go down to verse 19. "Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears." Possibly this happened after the defeat of the Ammonites, and the Philistines said, "Well, we may be next on the list, so while we have supreme power around here, we're going to execute all Israelite smiths, and therefore they'll have to come to us to sharpen their implements, and they won't be able to make weapons of war." And all of verse 20, "All the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share, and his coulter, his plowshare, and his axe and his mattock." And there's a curious verse, 21, which I won't waste your time with. "Yet they had a file for the mattocks and for the coulters." But there's a dispute over the Hebrew word translated file. And it's thought nowadays to be a kind of fee which the Philistine troops charged to sharpen the implements, the agricultural implements of the Israelites. And that's how what they had to do. They had to go to the Philistines to get their agricultural things sharpened, and they weren't allowed anything that would enable them to make things for themselves. So they had no weapons except those with the parties of Saul and Jonathan. Now chapter 14, and what a chapter this is. "It came to pass upon a day that Jonathan the son of Saul said unto the young man that bare his armour, Come and let us go over." Jonathan is going to jump the gun again, but by faith. He's working according to God's promises to Israel. I quote from Deuteronomy chapter 22. "How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight, except their rock had sold them and their Lord had shut them up?" And there's a glorious carrying out of this in Joshua 23 and verse 10. I'll read it from verse 8. "Cleave unto the Lord your God as ye have done this day. For the Lord hath driven out from before you great nations and strong. But as for you, no man hath been able to stand before you unto this day. One man of you shall chase 1,000. For the Lord your God, He it is that fighteth for you, as he hath promised you. And Saul didn't, but Jonathan believed that. And he believed with his young armor-bearer, who was equally a man of faith, a lad of faith with him, that with God and through prayer, they could go up and they could do a tremendous work against this Philistine garrison. Well, down in verse 4 of chapter 14, it begins, the episode proper. And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines' garrison, it was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side. Now, it's difficult to understand the description that we read here, and there are various interpretations of it. But obviously, it was a very high and rocky area. And if Jonathan and his armor-bearer were shrewd, they could somehow clamber up without the sentries, the lookouts of the Philistine garrison, being aware that they were there. There are different scenarios set before us concerning this, so I'm not really going to choose between them. One is that there's a long razor edge, and Jonathan got up, and when finally he engaged the Philistines, he was able to have such success by pulling one over the edge. As soon as he leaned over and looked, he pulled him over, and his armor-bearer a few feet lower slew him, and so on. And there are different scenes of this kind. But one thing I think is certain is that the Philistines in this narrative, they look over and they see Jonathan and his armor-bearer. They have deliberately revealed themselves to them, and they say here, these Hebrews are coming out of their holes. They say, these are the cowards, the ones who've been hiding. Here we are up here looking out, and why, if we only knew it, down here in all these folds and passes and behind these crags and in these caves, this is where they're all hiding. And probably, but this is speculation, probably the Philistine lookouts assumed that these were people coming over to their side, either for protection or to join with them, because they saw that Israel was finished. Her defenders were so small, the Philistines were so numerous. And so the record proceeds, and verse 6, more faith from Jonathan. He said to the young man that bare his armour, this is chapter 14, verse 6, come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. Some suggest that he means it contemptuously. I don't think he does. It's his way of saying, don't forget that we are the nation and God is with us. We are his people. These are not. They are pagan and they're against him and they're against God's cause. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. You see, he knew his Deuteronomy, and he knew his book of Joshua, though they weren't called that at that time. And his armor-bearer said unto him, do all that is in thine heart. He has the same faith and determination. So in verse 8, Jonathan says, well, he's prayed through this, and this is what he's sure is the right thing to do. We'll reveal ourselves to them. Verse 9, if they say, wait till we come to you, we'll stand our ground. But if they say, verse 10, come up unto us, then we will go up. And this will be a sign. He'd had it from God that they'd be delivered into their hand. So they did reveal themselves, verse 11. And the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews come out of the holes. They thought they were cowards. They thought they were coming over to their side. That's the most likely thing anyway. And the men of the garrison, verse 12, the lookouts, the sentries, said, come up to us and we will show you a thing. Or we'll show you something, we might say today. Some of the modern translations say, they said, come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson. As though they spoke threateningly or aggressively. But the Hebrew doesn't say that. It says exactly what our translation says. Come to us and we'll show you something. In other words, they assumed these people were cowards Jonathan and his armor bearer, and they were enticing them, not threatening them. So the sentries on the top of the ridge, how many people, Hebrews, did they think there were? Possibly hundreds of them. Possibly they thought there were lots of them there. I think that's why they trembled so much when things suddenly went wrong. There were only two, in fact, but they couldn't see with all into all the crevices and the cracks and the caves. They could only see Jonathan and his armor-bearer. So it was very steep. Verse 13, Jonathan went up using hands and feet. He climbed, and his armor-bearer, and they fell before him. And immediately the first slaughter, verse 14, caused a tremendous consternation, because 20 sentries were slain in no time at all. And verse 15, I'm not quite sure the right way to interpret this. There was a trembling in the host in the field. You could think that possibly there had been screams and yells and shouts, and the people near to hand thought there must be an enormous Hebrew contingent there, not realizing there were only two men. So there was a stampede to get away and to clamber down from those high places, and terror and alarm. And the trembling was caused by fear and the hustle to get away. And that became contagious, and it just spread through the whole crowd. Or you could think that as there was some sort of an earth tremor at the same time, it's mentioned a few words hence, sent by God, that actually started at the very beginning. I can't tell you which is the right way to look at it. Whether the fear started and it was then intensified by the earth tremor, or whether the earth tremor started the whole thing. But in verse 15, there was a trembling in the host, in the field, among the people, the garrison, and the spoilers. They also trembled, and the earth quaked, so it was a very great trembling. And so the Philistine host began to retreat and to flee. Now, this was God's help. This was God's overruling. And verse 16, the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah and of Benjamin looked, and behold, the Philistine multitude melted away, and they were beating down one another. And then they were pursued by the Israelites. The Israelites presumably picking up their weapons, armed by the Philistines in hasty retreat, as they had only clubs and staves and bows and arrows, presumably, and nothing better than that. But there's a lot of things in this chapter just to glance at, as we see that time is short, so perhaps I take you all the way down to verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, "Cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening." The rash curse of Saul. He didn't want the people hesitating but chasing after the enemy. So in order to get his command obeyed, he resorts to this foolish and cruel curse, which is going to be counterproductive. And of course it catches his own son, Jonathan, who had gone on ahead and had not heard this curse. So he ate. And I'm going to pass over this, but you see the cruelty of Saul. When it so happens that he wishes to consult God through the priest for guidance as to whether he should further pursue the Philistines, well, he didn't want to consult the priest. It's the priest who said to Saul, "Just a minute, shouldn't we consult the Lord? You're going ahead chasing the Philistines." "Oh, yes," said Saul, "you better do that." And the priest could get no response from God in the manner that was appointed for those times. And God only refused to respond if there was sin in the camp. And Saul assumed somebody had disobeyed his command and his curse. And so he investigates, and lots are drawn for that, and it comes down to Jonathan. And the pride of the man, of Saul that is so great that he would even have Jonathan, who's actually the hero of the day, executed because he had defied his father, even though he didn't know about the command. What an individual Saul has become. Disobedient to God, proud, shortcuts, foolish, vindictive, cruel, even to the point of the execution of his son. Of course, it all lies in the future, how he's going to try to kill David in due course. You can see the man who started in such a humble way is soon spoiled and ruined in his manner. Well, Jonathan is delivered by the will of the people, usually so weak they stood up for him. But I just want to come, as we conclude this evening, very briefly to the first part of chapter 15. And this will be our last phase. Samuel also said unto Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, hearken thou unto the voice of the words of the Lord." And Saul is given the task of finally destroying the Amalekites, the oldest enemy of Israel, and so vicious and so cruel, and still to that day. Verse 3 of chapter 15, "Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have." Now you know, I'm sure, so I won't read out all the verses, that Saul didn't do that. He struck at the Amalekites, having sent word to their first city that the Kenites, who weren't in his target, should leave, should get out. But then he attacked, and he pursued them. His destruction of the Amalekites wasn't all that efficient, because they continued to thrive for a while, and battles continued right down to David's time, and even afterwards. But however, though he did a great deal, he left the king of the Amalekites, Agag, alive. Why did he do that? He'd been told, it sounds cruel, I'm not going to go into the justification of it at the moment, but it was an order of God because of the evil and the wickedness and the treachery of the Amalekites. But why did he save the life of the king? What insights we get into Saul. He doesn't agree with God's instructions a lot of the time, or he thinks that approximate obedience is good enough. The latter, I think. I can save the king. I've been told to destroy everything and everyone. And I can save the best of the cattle, the flocks, the herds. He's an approximate obeyer of God. That's something to be warned of. I hope you and I are not like that. I'm a Christian man, woman. I worship the Lord. I believe in Jesus Christ. I try to live a moral life by the help of God. And I try to obey him. But yes, I don't do everything. I cut corners. I leave certain things out. I do go home and listen to dreadful music. And I do this and I do that. I'm an approximate. 70%, you may flatter yourself, 90%, God won't have it. That was Saul. That was his trouble. He was given commands, he obeyed 60%, 50%, 70%. When he was reproved by Samuel, he could not for the life of them see what Samuel was talking about or worrying about. He didn't understand. You obey God 100%. You don't rewrite his rules and his methods and his commands. And that's one of the chief things we have to learn from the life of Saul. And never be like that as he was. And then we come down to chapter 15 and verse 12. Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning. It was told Samuel, saying, "Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set him up a place." That means he built an altar. That's what it means. But look at what the people even are saying about Saul. He set him up a place. When Saul built an altar before, the narrative said he built it to the Lord. But now the people are getting cynical about Saul. They say he built a monument. He did it for himself. That's really the effect of their language. And that's, by the way, He's gone to Gilgal. And verse 13, Samuel came to Saul. And Saul, who's disobeyed God, left the king alive and got him there, the king of the Amalekites, and all the flocks and the herds. He says in a brazen way to Samuel, verse 13, "Blessed be thou of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." 50%. But as far as he's concerned, he's done it. And Samuel said, "What meaneth then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears, and the lowing of the oxen, the noise of sin?" It was all around, the evidence that he hadn't obeyed the commands. And Saul immediately blames it on the people. They have brought them from the Amalekites. And then he adds this excuse, "to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God." And Samuel says unto Saul, "I'll tell thee what the Lord hath said to me this night." Verse 17, "When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made the head of the tribes?" What painful verses these are. "When thou wast little." Perhaps it's true in some measure of us. When we were saved, we were so grateful. We were so humble. We were so dutiful. We were so eager to attend all the meetings. We were so eager to do the right things. And then we put some time behind us in the Christian life. And now we slip this and we slip that. And we're not so humble, and we don't feel so much our shortcomings as we did at first. "When thou wast little in thine own sight," the Lord keep us all little in our own sight. And the Lord sent thee on a journey, verse 18, "Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed." "You haven't obeyed," said Samuel. And Saul insists he has. He's, again, brazen. I'm sorry to keep using that word. Verse 20, "Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and have gone the way which the Lord sent me." And then he actually begins to bring as evidence tokens of his disobedience, "and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek." It's suggested, and I think it's true, I can't be sure, that he'd kept Amalek alive in order to get ransom money for him. Why else would he keep him alive? And where would he get the ransom money from? Presumably from all the Amalekites he'd left alive too. It looks dangerously like that. This obedience is dropping to 20% obedience as the verses roll by. "But the people took of the spoil, and they're blamed again." And here's a verse which could be a rather negative, I'm afraid, but a valuable motto text for us and for all God's people. Verse 22, "And Samuel said, Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams." Oh, isn't that a challenge to us? Much better to obey God, even than to worship, as important as worship is. I worship. I worship twice every Lord's Day. I do everything and am supportive. But it's obedience that God is primarily looking for from us and from all the church of God. And then it gets even worse. Verse 23, "For rebellion," disobedience to a command of God, even if we think we're doing all the other things right, "is as bad as witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry in the sight of God." Obedience is so precious. Now, I'm not going to deal with the repentance of Saul in verse 24. Leave that to another time. It was so phony. It was so hollow. But I just tell you a few things by way of encouragement as we close. Saul is the opposite of Christ. The opposite in so many ways. How can we exalt Christ from the life of Saul? Well, by seeing he is a perfect picture of the opposite. He was so handsome. He was head and shoulders in stature above all others. But the Saviour had no form or comeliness that we should desire him. He had no superior body like a Samson to help carry him through his toils and trials. He had no figure and appearance that would compel attraction. And he was the opposite from Saul in so many other ways. Saul spoiled quickly. The Lord had his temptations from Satan, and he was tempted without sin. He stood firm, the perfect man. Saul dithered. And Jonathan had to be the one who pressed forward the campaign. Christ never dithered. Every moment of his short life for us on earth, he went about doing good, perfectly fulfilling the plan of redemption, unselfishly, every second of the time. Saul did not know what to do from one moment to the next. Christ knew every step he would take, every detour, every person he would heal, every group he would address. He knew exactly the plan and the moment and the hour when he would shed his blood for our redemption. Saul was so cruel. He could curse his men if they deviated or disobeyed. Christ was infinitely kind. He came solely to go to Calvary for his people. Saul was so fearful on so many occasions, but Christ went through with everything. All the cruelty, all the hostility, the opposition, the nails, the thorns, and the punishment from his Father on high on our behalf. Saul disobeyed Christ, faithful unto death. Saul so foolish, Christ so wise. What could be more wise than the plan of redemption? Saul so proud, he would execute his son because he thought he made him look small. Christ suffered constant humiliation, though he was the King of glory, for us, and suffered it willingly. Saul rejected by God, Christ and his offering accepted by the Father. Saul insincere, as we'll see in due course, in his repentance, in his promises, in his excuses. Christ, total integrity, every promise he made, he keeps perfectly. Saul had no succession. He was allowed to reign to the end of his years, but he had no successors on the throne. Christ, of course, has billions of successors who are heirs with him and enjoy the eternal glory with him. One of the things the monarchy will show, occasionally there'll be a good king who is in some respects, not all, a worthy type prefiguring of Christ. Most often the king is so human and so weak and so fallible, and it causes us to say, oh, for the coming Christ, who will be the opposite and perfect and wonderful in every way. So I find even the dismal aspects of King Saul shed light on the wonders of our dear Saviour. And that's sufficient for us this evening. Let's close singing the hymn 458.